This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about jerks at work and how to tell if you're one of them. Now, a new group of scientific studies says Facebook's algorithms can amplify political news, but stop short of outright affecting political polarization. Our next guest has been studying political polarization in Wisconsin and how it fits into media and social media, and he played a unique role in this new research on Facebook. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you talk politics over Facebook or maybe Instagram? Do you see a lot of political messages popping up? And how about back in 2020, the presidential election? What did you see there? Do you think it maybe changed people's minds? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Wagner is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
Before we get into the results of this study, you have a really unique vantage point. You played a special role. Can you talk about the research and then where you came in?
Sure. So the research is 17 academics at universities around the country partnering with social science researchers who work at Meta, which we used to call Facebook, and they partnered together to study the 2020 U.S. election with a variety of papers that they're writing, some of which are now out and published, which is why this has all been in the news. And they've been working on this since the spring of 2020. And since that time, I have been the project rapporteur, which is the fancy name they gave to the person who is watching, observing, taking notes about all of these meetings. So I'm observing the meetings between the Meta researchers and the academic researchers to see if, one, Meta is kind of getting researchers to do things they wouldn't normally do to make Meta look good. Two, to see if this kind of collaborative thing could be a model for future research between academics and social media platforms. And three, to talk about the process, some of the strengths and weaknesses of doing really high-level social science research in this way, which partners with social media companies, which lots of people don't trust.
And this has been tough research to do for people for a long time because you kind of, I think a lot of researchers have been working with whatever scraps they can glean online because Facebook and these other social media companies, they're businesses, they don't want to release their stuff. This study gets at some of it. You wrote up a thing on this saying, yes, we got pretty good research on this, but this may not be a model for good research in the future. Why is that?
Well, a lot of reasons, but that's right. So on the one hand, I conclude, and I do think that the researchers who work at Meta, who study the effects of their platform, you know, for the company, the people who do that research are good social scientists. They care about learning the right answers to questions, but they also work at a social media company that has a bottom line, and some research findings are going to want to promote, and some that they're not. The outside academics wanted access to data they could only get if they partnered with Meta to do the work. And so they had to make some compromises, like they wouldn't actually get the raw data. Now, the process they underwent to do the work, I think, was trustworthy, but we should be really skeptical of research where the people whose names are on the studies and the first names, the leaders of the project, never actually got to physically handle the raw data in the way that they do and everything else that they do. So that's one reason. I would say another is that they didn't really get to guide the workflow. Because they didn't get to actually be touching the data, the researchers and staffers at Meta were doing the work. Now, the outside academics would look at all of the code and review it and even could screen share and watch things happen in real time, but they didn't get to actually touch it, and they didn't get to really decide the order of the way that work went because it's not their company, right? And so that also affected which papers came out first. The ones that came out first have shown smaller effects from Facebook on American politics. Ones that are coming later might show bigger effects that might make Meta look worse, but what we're talking about is the big splash, which is the effects are not huge.
Yeah, let's look at that now. At least in the first papers, this big open question is, did the existence and massive size of Facebook and what happened on it, the algorithms that fed us this and not that, did it change us politically in some way? From these earliest studies, what are our provisional answers to those questions?
One study experimentally altered the feeds that different people saw on Facebook. And I think it's important to note that everybody who was a Facebook user who was a part of the study knew it. Mm-hmm. They were asked if they would participate, and they consented to do so. So it wasn't like a lot of other research Facebook has done with academics where it happened and nobody knew that it was happening mm-hmm. while it was happening. This is stuff people knew was happening. And some people had the algorithm change. So instead of getting what Facebook wanted them to see, they saw what's called a reverse chronological feed. In other words, the most recent post of a friend you have on Facebook. And that resulted in more untrustworthy content. It resulted in a decrease in the amount of uncivil and hateful content. So that might be good. It saw an increase in moderate posts from friends who were ideologically mixed, but it didn't affect people's overall issue polarization, so their attitudes about issues. It didn't affect their affective polarization, which is their attitude about the other side in politics. And it actually didn't affect their knowledge either. So the Facebook algorithm, experimentally in this study in the U.S. for the 2020 election, did not affect those things in a major way.
And how did we measure those things, their views toward people they disagree with, their opinions on issues? Were there surveys along the way?
So in addition to looking at people's behaviors on Facebook, they also did a six-wave panel survey, which means they interviewed the same people six times from before the election season in the summer through after the events of January 6th, after the election was over. And so they have survey research data, and then they also have what Facebook calls classifiers. So Facebook will look at the things you post and the words you use when you post them, and they'll develop an algorithmic way of deciding, do we think you're a liberal or do we think you're a conservative? So they use Facebook's classifiers for ideology, for hateful content, and other kinds of things. But they also use the survey research where they ask the users direct questions about their attitudes and behaviors.
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, looking at a big and ongoing research of Facebook, politics on Facebook, some experiments to see how their algorithm affected people's political views. You can join in with your questions about that research at 800-642-1234 and your personal experiences with political views on social media. Do you avoid these things? Do you repost things? Join in at 800-642-1234. Mike, as I understand it, another thing they tested was people's ability to repost articles. And does having that ability versus not having it change political views? Why was that important to measure? What did we find out?
Well, one thing we worry about on social media is that misinformation can get amplified because people reshare it, right? They see it, and then not only do they see it, they share it. They retweet it, they share it, or whatever the term is on the social media platform you're on. And so one thing they did in the studies, they removed reshared content from some people's feeds. And they found that when they removed reshared content, people actually decreased their news knowledge, and it didn't affect polarization. There were other effects that it had as well. There was just, it was less engagement and those sorts of things on Facebook. But it didn't have the positive effect that researchers hypothesized that it might.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us in Amory. Ryan, hi.
Hi. I think the suggestion that Facebook did not affect the polarization is absolutely asinine. The study is already suspect. The company controls all of the data, and none of this is looking at the 2000s when the polarization kicked up. Facebook is wholly responsible, or not wholly, there are other companies too, but yes, Facebook is obviously responsible.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Mike?
This is a common critique of these studies, and so, and I think it's fair to make the critique that the caller is making. Our other things we can say are that we've had polarization in the United States since we've had it. We had a civil war, a full century and a half before we had social media. So there have been deep political divides that had nothing to do with social media. Social media is not required to have it. There's also lots of evidence from other research, not a part of this particular study, that social media does amplify polarization in different kinds of ways, or it amplifies it for particular populations, especially ones that might engage in really dangerous, undemocratic, or violent kinds of behaviors. What the research showed here is that during the election season, Facebook didn't make it worse. Now, maybe looking during a highly partisan election season isn't the time to look for social media's role in polarization. Maybe you'd want to look in the years in between elections to see whether people are getting stewed up. People are really not very likely to decrease their partisanship right before an election. And so we shouldn't maybe expect that to happen.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. One thing I wonder about, Mike, is we hear a lot about negative partisanship. I'm voting against that side as opposed to for my candidate. And also people, like partisan identity being a key marker of identity, maybe more than religion or even political views and
people.
Things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know how, I mean, I'm not a social science researcher. I don't know how I'd measure the impact of Facebook on that. It feels to me like that social media could reinforce that by making a user feel like I am part of this community with these attitudes shared and I'm against that community. I don't know how I'd measure that kind of change. Is that something that's coming in this research?
So there are different ways to measure that kind of change. So one thing you might do is say, here are a lot of different ways people think about who they are. Their partisanship, their gender, whether they're a parent, where they live, their job, their likes and dislikes. So there's lots of different things that feed into our identity, their faith, all these things. And you might ask people to rank them. And then you might ask them over and over to rank them. Mm-hmm. And if you see political identity getting closer to the top or closer to the bottom in response to something you're seeing on social media platforms, then you might be able to start to draw a conclusion about how that kind of thing works. Or if you look at things over time, like the caller made a great point in that our current era of polarization really began a couple of decades ago, really 3 decades ago, before Facebook. But once Facebook came on the scene, it really turned, you know, kind of shot into overdrive. And so, you know, if we had been looking in the way that we're looking now, back in 2008, maybe the findings would be quite different.
Mike Wagner is with us, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. He was an independent auditor, in effect, of a unique study of Facebook and Instagram and their impact on U.S. politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What thoughts do you have? What questions do you have about social media algorithms, their influence on politics, how we try to measure that impact, if any? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mike Wagner, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, looking at recent studies reviewing the influence of Facebook's algorithms on political polarization. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences with the political divide on social media. Say, back over the last 5 years ago, did you stop communicating with someone on social media because of the political divide? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, before we go back to our callers, another issue that I know you followed here in Wisconsin as well is the idea of ideological segregation on social media and other media outlets you've tracked here in Wisconsin. What kind of things do we see as we look at this data from Facebook?
Well, we see data that actually matches pretty closely the work we've done in Wisconsin. We found a substantial number of Wisconsin conservatives, about a quarter, tend to consume conservative-leaning news only and or talk to just conservatives about politics and not tend to talk to others. There's a far lower number of liberals who engage in that safe behavior in Wisconsin. And the Facebook study, in terms of social media, found something quite similar. They found that there was a large asymmetry between the information consumed exclusively by individuals on the right, and they found that most misinformation exists within that particular corner of the Facebook ecosystem. And so they tended to find that sources favored by conservative audiences tended to dominate the Facebook news ecosystem, and they were more likely to find misinformation in those sources. Not exclusively or anything like that, but just more likely to find that. Now the work we did in Wisconsin didn't deal with misinformation from sources. It just dealt with use. But they're similar in that the asymmetry was similar, that there was a larger element of conservative media use purely as compared to liberal media use purely.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Dave on the line in Sussex. Dave, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a consumer of all types of information. I listen to NPR. I listen to conservative talk radio. I seek news stories. I am a critical thinker. And anybody that's a critical thinker can obviously conclude that Facebook and Twitter and these other social media companies absolutely had a large part to play in the polarization in this country based on them deleting information, defined as misinformation. That's basically information that you don't agree with or things that you would prefer people not to say because it hurts your viewpoint and your cause. So you have to take that out of the realm of public forums and squash that information so other people can't hear about it and all that kind of stuff. So absolutely, Facebook was horrible at that, and they should be held liable for a lot of this stuff, people's accounts getting taken off. And
I gotcha, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call. Dave's definition of misinformation may be a different one than you use when you study a social media, Mike?
Maybe so, but I think one thing that is consistent with what I heard Dave saying was that one reason Meta, which is now Facebook's parent company, one reason Meta wanted to do this project and wanted to partner with outside academics to do it was they recognized what a PR hit they took after the 2016 election with the Cambridge Analytica scandal about people's data being used and people being targeted with misinformation in swing states and all of that kind of thing in the 2016 election on Facebook. And they wanted to partner with outside academic researchers, hoping that the public, that journalists and other academics would trust the data more if it was more than just researchers who worked for the social media company saying, here, this is what we found. Mm-hmm. And so that was, I think, behind their goal of trying to organize or organize this effort. But, the common response I think we get in the public is much more consistent with what we've heard in the calls.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jeff now in Shawano. Jeff, hi.
Hey, thanks again for taking the call. So I just had a question for the professor regarding like the legitimacy of the data. So I just wanted a little bit of clarification there. So first of all, like when you say that the social media companies are working with outside researchers, but from what I understood you say, they still control the data that those researchers are getting. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so the Facebook, the Meta controlled the access to the platform data. They controlled access to data where a user of the platform's privacy was at stake, because they have federal regulations and other international ones they have to abide by there. And so usually what happens is the academics who want to partner with the company become a temporary employee of the company, and then that gives them the right to have access to the data. Here, the academics said, we don't want any financial entanglement mm-hmm. with Facebook because that'll impugn our integrity. And so let's instead not have a financial entanglement. And the trade-off is we don't have pure, unrestricted access to the data.
And Jeff, did you want to know more beyond that?
Yeah, can I just ask one? Then can I just make one point really
quick?
Sure. So a lot of the polarization and this is just again my opinion. I watch Joe Rogan, I watch Ben Shapiro, right? Like I dance around the spectrum as far as pundits and new news media, right? The long form conversation. I feel like a lot of the polarization comes from the lack of the lack of trust in these organizations that we've seen, especially coming out like with Matt Taibbi and the Twitter files, and seeing that there is a certain demographic that is disproportionately represented in the employment of these companies and these big tech companies, and it typically leans to one political party, which I think a lot of us understand would be the left.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have too much time left, but that there is a perception definitely among conservatives that, the people who work in Silicon Valley are to the left. Is this something you run into a perception at least a lot, Mike?
Yeah. I think there's an overwhelming perception that most employees in Silicon Valley are of the left politically. I think there's evidence that most academics are to the left, or at least moderate. There's fewer conservative academics. There's not a balance of that either. And so I think a common critique is of ideology. And the researcher's response to that is, this is why we engage in the scientific process. This is why we have blind peer review of our studies. This is why we had an independent auditor watching us so who could comment on it. Those are the common perceptions that we hear about how Silicon Valley works, about how the academy works, about how the news media works. And so these are common critiques.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Mike Wagner about new research on Facebook's influence or lack of say about political polarization. as we've mentioned a couple times, Mike, these are just the first couple studies coming out of this bigger project. What so far to you stands out as a big unanswered question that is hopefully answerable?
That's a great question. I think it would be great to know how long different effects last. And so if polarization gets worse or stays the same, is that something that lasts for a long time, or does it just last around election day? How long do these things last, and how does the duration of an effect influence your subsequent behavior and your subsequent attitudes?
One thing, a concern for a while, was that Facebook rewarded engagement.
Yes.
Engagement could be 40 people having a fun conversation about a topic, or it could be two people making 20 comments each arguing with each other. There was a reward system for controversial topic that generated heated and not always productive debate. Is that something that is part of the story here?
Yeah, that is something that the researchers found a little bit of. They did find regarding the reverse chronological feed, it decreased the amount of uncivil and hateful content on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So the algorithm is kicking up stuff that's more emotional.
Right.
And so when they did away with that, we saw less of it. So there's definitely something that this study is consistent with.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike had a special role as an auditor of sorts on a series of studies reviewing Facebook's influence on political polarization. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this, and this could be fodder for a future show. Have you seen politics on social media change over the years as some of these companies have changed their algorithms, maybe in some cases responding to public criticism? Do you think they've done a good job, or do you still see a lot of stuff you don't want to see? And have you, as I asked earlier, stopped communicating with somebody on social media because of political differences? You can do an old-fashioned social media. You can email us. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org, and let us know what you are seeing online. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, an estimated 500,000 people deal with diabetes here in Wisconsin. Join Kate with some diabetes experts, get the latest on prevention and the latest treatments and access to those treatments, and join the conversation yourself if you have a story. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, everybody can agree, I think, that toxic coworkers can make even a dream job pretty miserable. But most people wouldn't admit that they are the problem coworker. In fact, many people have no idea that they might be in the wrong. Our next guest is a psychologist who's been studying workplace dynamics, and in a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal, she raises the question, what if the jerk is you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had that annoying, problematic, flat-out toxic coworker, or worse, boss? What do they do? Or have you ever realized that you were the problem? If so, how did you fix it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tessa West is a professor of psychology at New York University and author of the book Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. Tessa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I mentioned most people wouldn't admit that they're the problem, but in your book, one of your first examples of when somebody's being kind of a jerk at the workplace, you give yourself. Very honest and refreshing. Could you talk about that story and how it got you thinking about jerks at work?
Yeah, I think there's nothing like a little lesson in humility to motivate you to write a book on this topic. Yeah, you know, I study interpersonal behavior, and I study how to smooth over uncomfortable interactions. And I actually found myself in a power role at work, relative, it's academia, not a ton of power, but I was in charge of an office move. And what I found was that people who normally like me were coming to me and they were crying in my office. They didn't like, you know, that I had moved them to a room with a weird pole in the middle of it, or that I was, you know, being really domineering and bulldozing and taking over. And I kind of turned into this nightmarish version of myself. And I felt very alone and sad, and I felt very sorry for myself that I had become a jerk. But then I realized if I don't have the skills to deal with this stuff, you know, how are regular people who aren't trained social psychologists supposed to deal with it? And honestly, no one told me. I kind of just figured this out by processing it with friends and with coworkers. But really, no one ever came to me and said, look, you've been a real jerk. Like, you need to change your behavior. So that was a good lesson for me.
And that's part of your lesson in this Wall Street Journal piece, is that a part of the reason we might be jerks and stay jerks is we're all too nice to tell each other and, you know, bring up that this is a problem in the first place. How big a part of the story is that?
Yeah, I think it's a huge part. I think there's not a strong norm to confront, partly because we don't really learn how to confront wisely at work. We tend to just avoid confrontation because we don't know how to say to someone, I don't like your behavior. Instead, what we do is we talk about how we feel disrespected. You know, we talk about people in terms of their personality traits, you know, you don't trust me or you're not a trustworthy person. And those kind of big, scary things tend to make people super defensive. They engage in reverse blame. Well, maybe if you had it together, I wouldn't have to micromanage you and things like that. So these conversations go poorly and we learn this very early. And so we avoid them. And then if you throw power in there or status in there, it's way worse. And so as a consequence, we're not getting feedback that the little things we're doing are irritating people that really add up to the big things. And, you know, we avoid giving it to people and it really kind of creates this bad situation for everybody.
So what are the red flags we should watch out for to figure out, hey, I'm the problem here?
Yeah, I think kind of one of my favorite red flags doesn't really feel like a flag at all. It's just the absence of positive feedback. So I think most of us expect that if we're behaving badly, we're going to get a lot of negative feedback at work. But what I've actually found is that if you're the jerk, people will not respond to those email requests from hiring managers or recruiters who are looking to see what you were like to work with. You know, favors go unanswered. Nobody shows up to your happy hour that you put together. It's more like crickets. It's more like tumbleweeds. An absence of positive feedback, not so much a presence of negative feedback that's telling you that maybe your behavior isn't so welcome in the workplace. So I think a lot of us don't attend to not getting any feedback as a form of a sign that we're a jerk. But I think that's actually one of the kind of biggest signs that we get is people just aren't weighing in. They're not helping you out. They're not putting in a good word for you.
Talking to psychology professor Tessa West from New York University, author of the book Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. She wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about figuring out if we are the problem, if we're the jerk at the workplace. You could join in with your thoughts, experiences, maybe, or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Tessa, maybe we've spotted that red flag, that absence of positive feedback, and we want to figure out. So I don't know how I would do this. Hey, everybody, how am I terrible? Tell me how I'm terrible. Like, I don't, this isn't something I necessarily, a conversation I want to start.
Yeah, definitely don't ask people how you're terrible. They're going to say, no, you're so great. I love working with you. And then you're going to walk away and they're gonna be like, he's terrible. No, what you have to do is ask for feedback about the very specific things you do. Don't ask for feedback about what people think of you. And I think we tend to not think of feedback as like bite-sized and immediate. You know, say you have a meeting with someone and then at the end of it, you say, how did that go? Did you feel like you had a chance to speak up? Or, you know, did I cut you off too many times? Or when I went through that document of yours, did you feel like I was kind of line item editing too much or not enough? Ask for just really kind of specific, almost mundane level of feedback that people aren't scared to be honest about. The closer it is to just a very specific behavior, the more likely they are to actually tell you what they think. So they're not going to tell you that they think you're terrible, but they probably will tell you if they didn't feel like they had a chance to speak up or they felt like, you know, maybe you interrupted them too many times or maybe your feedback was a little too vague. Whatever the thing is, the more specific you ask, the better. And I think if you don't have a culture of feedback where you work, or where you live, start with really boring, mundane things that just warm people up to the idea of giving you any kind of feedback. You know, in my workplace where there's some status differences between, say, me and an undergrad, I'll ask them what they want to do for catering for lunch, just to get them to be comfortable with just giving me feedback about anything. And warm them up to it and get them used to it before I ask for real stuff, you know? And I think we often kind of forget that initial step that makes people much more comfortable.
I want to talk about a specific kind of jerk that's a hazard in my profession, I think. I haven't encountered this here so much, but elsewhere in the country, public radio hosts in some cases, former public radio hosts and other people in the media who say, yeah, I'm a jerk. That's because I'm demanding. I have high standards. If I yell at you, there's a good reason for it. My way or the highway. You don't like that? Then find another job. The self-justifying jerk. How can we get people, and I don't appreciate that attitude, by the way. How do we get people out of that mindset if that's where they are?
Jerks are born out of cultures that promote them. I think a lot of us think jerks are bad apples, but often they really grow and flourish in places that allow that to happen. I think you have to frame it as a loss for their behavior to continue. Insofar as they get to do those things that they can yell at you, scream at you, and they still get promoted and their boss still loves them, it's really hard to fight against a culture that promotes jerks. And what I tell people is, if that's what you're up against, and that the culture really feeds it and loves it, you're probably going to want to take a new job. But if that person is doing that and they're not actually realizing the real harm it's doing to them, then you have to really frame their behavior as a loss. You know, because you're doing X, the following things have personally negatively affected you. You've lost this person, and this person. Turnover is expensive. Now you're going to have to retrain them. So make it expensive for people to act that way. Expensive in terms of time, expensive in terms of money, whatever resource they care about, they have to feel like they're going to lose that resource if they continue their behavior. Don't try to go with like a bleeding hearts approach. It would be so much better if you were just nicer. Why would they care? What are they going to lose by continuing this behavior? And I think this is true when you approach a boss as well. If you have a jerk at work, your boss loves them. Well, what is your boss going to lose if they continue to let this happen? Are they going to lose other employees? Are they going to lose sales? What's it going to be? Focus on that, and then people will change their behavior, because it really has to be extrinsically motivated at that point.
Tessa West is a professor of psychology at New York University, author of the book Jerks at Work. We're talking to her about office jerks, bad coworkers and bosses, and how to know if you are the problem. You could join in at 800-642-1234. It's awesome, though, because we're here in Wisconsin. Nobody's calling. I guess we're all great coworkers here. Nobody's had a bad experience like this. Maybe you did. Call in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about a time when you caught yourself being the problem, or an unsolved workplace culture where these kind of problems were let go, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tessa West, professor of psychology at New York University and author of the book Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. Talk about how to tell if you're behaving like a jerk at work and what to do about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story you're willing to share about a self-discovery moment where you realized, hey, I'm causing the problem here at work. How did you figure that out? How did you fix it? Are you in a workplace where jerkiness of one form or another is tolerated? Join in at 800-642-1234. Did you find ways to fix it? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Janet is with us in Burlington. Janet, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up, I think, as a former retired naval officer and civilian supervisor, a lot has to do with who is the employer. You know, if it's a right-to-work employer, you can just say to a person as a supervisor, you know, this really isn't working out, and you really don't have to document. But if you are a federal employee or a state or city employee, you have to go through the whole progressive discipline thing. There are actually books written about how to fire a federal employee, because so many times it's so difficult that people just don't do it, and they just keep on passing somebody's problem on to the next employer.
Janet, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Tessa, I mean, it may be easier or harder to hire a jerk in one workplace or another. I'm guessing there's no such thing as a completely jerk-proof kind of environment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love this point, because we often underplay the role of the structure of the workplace has. We often think about the workplace as having structures to protect us from jerks, but some of those things that protect us can actually make it harder to fire the jerks themselves. And I think federal versus state, you know, union is another example of that. People often feel protected by their unions, but it's very difficult to fire a jerk who's a union employee as well. So I think kind of, you know, the nice part about this comment is that when you interview for a job, knowing exactly what those structures and systems are in place to protect you, but also to protect a potential jerk is really, really important. And in some workplaces, they just pass the baton over. You know, the jerk goes from kind of one silo to another because it's really hard to fire that person, or it's expensive, or that, you know, retraining is really hard. And I see this a lot. One of the biggest complaints I get is similar to this, which is just, there's not a structure in place to actually clean out a jerk in an easy way. It's too hard. It's too expensive. They have too many protections. But a lot of people don't ask about those kinds of structures and systems when they're interviewing. And I think knowing what steps are in place and where to go and who's going to be protected, the victim or the jerk, is also something that we can highlight. And I think people have kind of complained to me from both sides of this, that these jerks are being protected, but also the victims are being protected. So I think it really depends on the perspective. But I like the kind of highlighting the higher level structural component here and how that feeds into this problem.
Thanks for that call, Janet, at 800-642-1234. Anne joins us now in Duluth. Hi, Anne.
Hi. A while back, I was working with someone who was extremely sarcastic and very short with people, really unpleasant. And one day she invited me out for lunch, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'd rather not eat. I was kind of young at the time. And so she said to me very directly, why don't people like me? And I remember thinking, I can either tell her the truth, or I can just say, oh, I don't know why you would think that. People like you, and lie, which I really wanted to do. But in a nice way, I told her the truth. And it was interesting because she turned it around, and she ended up marrying a guy we worked with. And we were all good friends, and it just turned out so much differently than what I had expected originally.
Wow, fascinating story, Anne, and so right on with what we're talking about, Tessa. Not many people would do what Anne's coworker did, and as you were saying earlier, not everybody would answer the way Anne did.
I love that. And I think it highlights this point that we often assume jerks are out to get us, that they're doing it intentionally, and that they're doing it knowingly. And I think often jerks don't even know they're jerks. In fact, their behavior is more costly to them than it is to other people, or at least just as costly. So just a little bit of a wake-up call often goes over a little bit more positively than we think. And I think a lot of the people that I've coached, they have no idea how they're coming across to others. No one's ever told them, and they're much more receptive to feedback than I ever thought they would be. In fact, I usually tiptoe around this. I warm them up to it. And once I tell them, I sort of do that grin and bear it thing. And they tend to just say, thank you so much. No one's really ever given me any kind of feedback like this. So it's lovely when it works out. And I think it's great that this person was receptive. And it just sounds like they just never were told. Chances are they probably have had that problem for a really long time in their life. They had a hard time making friends in high school, maybe never quite got to the bottom of the issue. So I think that highlights this point that sometimes we just have no idea how we're coming across to other people.
Thanks again for that call, Anne. Let's flip things around, Tessa. If someone in Anne's situation, they hadn't gotten that outreach, but they think this person's probably all right, but they probably don't know. Like, is there a good etiquette to reach out and tell somebody, not you're a jerk, but here are the things that are, I don't know, how do we have that conversation?
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky conversation. I think kind of there's a few principles around it. One is, you don't want to tell someone that you think they're sarcastic. I mean, this person called themselves sarcastic. You know, you want to focus on the very specific things that they're doing. And when you do it, what you want to do is bring up the behavior. I noticed that you, in the last meeting, you talked for most of the time. Is that something that you noticed as well? So you want it to be a back and forth. You don't want to just kind of deliver information. You want to bring up a behavior. You want to maybe say what you thought that behavior was indicating, and then ask them what they meant by that behavior. One of the biggest mistakes we make is assuming that we know why people are doing what they're doing. We make what are called attributions. We automatically infer the cause for behaviors, when in reality, we often don't know those things. So simply just asking people, why did you do that? Or what did you mean by that? Feels way less threatening than saying, when you did it, you meant X. And I think as you go through this process, you also want to make it a two-way street. And most people don't like this, but when you're giving someone feedback that they're being a jerk, you want to ask them for feedback about you as well. You want to kind of insert into the conversation, do you have feedback for me? Or what did you think when I did this thing in the meeting? How did that come across? So that it feels like both of you are just giving each other feedback and asking for feedback. you know, it's a little bit of a Trojan horse way of kind of delivering the news, but it makes people feel much more comfortable if they feel like they're not just being attacked and kind of, you know, being yelled at or being shamed for their behavior. Hmm. But
thanks to our guest, Tessa West, professor of psychology at New York University, author of the book, Jerks at Work.